From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Pope Francis arrived in the nation's capital this week, only the third pontiff in history to do so. He bore a message of peace, refuge, compassion, and the sanctity of life for ourselves and for our planet.
Let us treat others with the same passion and compassion with which we want to be treated.
So naturally, in the comprehensive coverage of his historic visit, the Pope was widely treated as just the latest larger-than-life character adding his two cents to the three-penny opera.
The most important player in the 2016 election about to touch down in America. Pope Francis is coming to the United States. Is he headed for a collision course with Donald Trump on immigration?
He wants us to open our doors to more immigrants. So who's got it right, the Donald or the Pope?
Donald Trump, he has a message for the Pope.
I'd say ISIS wants to get you.
Even the nominally analytic coverage tended to characterize Francis as a politician in a skullcap. Not only were his teachings on moral obligation toward the welfare of humanity treated as partisan rhetoric, they were framed as if Francis were a candidate himself, courting the U.S. electorate.
58% of Ohio voters are with the Pope. 59% of Florida voters say the same. 63% of Pennsylvania voters back the pontiff.
Republicans, however, they think they've got an ally in the Pope because of abortion. And in fact, the day that he lands...
New approval ratings are out for the Pope. And they aren't too good. We'll break down the numbers.
Approval ratings? It seems not to have occurred to ABC's Eva Pilgrim that a pope has bigger fish to fry. As The Atlantic's Emma Green put it in her essay this week, the pope doesn't care. He is not Carly Fiorina or Bernie Sanders. He won the only election he ever needed. White smoke was issued. He is most likely not watching the polls. Nor choosing sides in domestic American politics. If you were grading the Pope on policy points, the way advocacy organizations rate candidates on their issues, you might indeed conclude that the world's most influential pro-lifer is a godsend for the staunchly anti-abortion majority of the GOP. Yet conservative media denounced Francis as a Trojan horse for commie poison.
This is just pure Marxism coming out of the mouth of the Pope.
I'm going to applaud when some left-wing nonsense about the environment comes across as if it's Catholic dogma. How could anybody applaud to that?
The same people who gave us Obama gave us this Pope.
This Pope is a world government promoting, anti-gun, global government carbon tax guy, and it's sick.
And this from Stuart Varney of Fox Business.
I don't think Christian people, ministers, popes, priests, whatever, I don't think they should be preaching politics from the pulpit.
Stuart, I swear I've never used this expression before in my life, but for God's sake, get over yourself. Maybe you see the world as an eternal battle for house seats, but that doesn't mean Pope Francis does. You're projecting, dude. This isn't about you. The problem, of course, isn't that political pundits are hammers that think everything is a nail, and the problem certainly isn't that the Pope is going all George McGovern on us. The problem is that in our hyper-politicized media culture, nothing in the world is immune from partisanship and polemic. Not atmospheric crisis, not evolution, not vaccination, not economic history, not even hunger. What should the leader of the church talk about then? Deflategate? Which brings us, as it often does, to a moment of sanity from Fox News Channel's Shepard Smith.
Caring for the marginalized and the poor, that's now political. Advancing economic opportunity for all, political. Serving as good stewards of the environment. Protecting religious minorities and promoting religious freedom globally. Welcoming and integrating immigrants and refugees globally. And that's political. These seem like universal truths, that we should be good to others who have less than we do, that we should give shelter to those who don't have it. I think these were the teachings in the Bible of Jesus.
Sorry, Shep. In a nation that treats elections like seasons of Survivor, there's no room for highest aspirations, just the lowest common denominator, fed with the dramaturgy of conflict. hero or villain, compatriot or nemesis, maverick or team player? Will Pope Francis get an audience with Sheldon Adelson? How will he go over with Big Labor? The Bible of Jesus? Seriously? Francis is headed for Pennsylvania, my friend, and that is a swing state. One Roman Catholic congressman, Republican Paul Gozer of Arizona, was so disturbed by reports that the Pope might discuss climate change, and he did, that Gozer actually boycotted the address to Congress. The climate, the congressman reminded the pontiff in a statement, quote, has been changing since first created in Genesis. You might be tempted to call Congressman Gozer a climate change skeptic or denier, but the Associated Press would advise against that. This week, the AP announced a change to its style book on global warming. In the guide that dictates usage for the AP and many U.S. news organizations, the editors suggest, quote, climate change doubters, or the wordier, those who reject mainstream climate science, instead of skeptics or deniers. Seth Borenstein is a science reporter for the AP. He provided guidance on these style book changes. Seth, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you, Bob.
Why these changes? Why now?
This discussion has been going on for a long time in media and in the field of climate change. The group, the Center for Inquiry, which are traditional skeptics of pseudoscience, they sent letters to all sorts of media saying they don't like the term skeptics because that's what they called themselves for decades. Their feeling was they use the scientific method in their inquiry, and that's not what the people who reject mainstream climate science do.
Why doubters instead of deniers?
Well, this is all about precision. We at the AP hadn't used denier, skeptics, or doubters in any regular way. There was no style book entry there. So when we were deciding to not use skeptics, the logical decision is what to use. And if you go through the possibilities, one of the problems with denier is that it has a connotation that is associated with the Holocaust in many ways.
If the subject is precision, it strikes me that obscuring clear language because of negative associations is a very dangerous accommodation. And secondly, doubt means a feeling of uncertainty or a lack of conviction. Deny is to state that one refuses to admit the truth or existence of. And those who deny human responsibility for global warming are doing just that. They're not expressing, I'm not really sold on this. They're expressing, no, this doesn't exist. Wrong word, Seth.
As someone who's covered climate change for more than 20 years, the trouble is the spectrum of those who reject mainstream climate science is not a simple binary thing. It's not deny, accept. Let me give you one good example. John Christie is a professor at the University of Alabama, Huntsville. He acknowledges that the world is warming. He acknowledges that it is man-made. What he differs with mainstream climate science is how bad it is, how much of a threat it is. So can you call him a climate denier? No. So the best phrase overall, the most precise phrase, is those who reject mainstream climate science. But you have to shorten that at some point, especially in a headline. Climate rejector sounds like an engine part.
Yes, it does. And maybe we need 474 words for snow. But it's just hard for me to get my head around the idea of substituting a word that is insufficient for one that does most of the job pretty well.
It does most of the job pretty well according to one side. Granted, that side has the majority of science on it.
Seth, I apologize. I'm going to cut you off here. One side, this is the very definition of false balance.
No one has accused me of false balance, so don't you go there. All you have to do is Google my name, Seth Borenstein, look at the images and see what the group that you call deniers, we call doubters, look at what they've done to me personally and to the AP. To say that I'm giving in to them is just not something that's ever happened. It's not something I've ever been accused of before.
May I say that there are two sides of a political debate, but if there is fundamentally no scientific debate, why would you think of this in terms of both sides that require fair treatment? Any more than you would treat Holocaust deniers as having one side in the issue of history. I just don't get it.
There is no false balance in the way AP covers the science. But there's a difference between the science and the semantics. We're not talking, you and I, about the science right now. We're talking about the semantics. And there are different sides on the semantics. I've been using climate doubter for months and no one said anything.
Seth, I hate to rub your nose in this, but if the AP's deliberations on this matter began with the complaints by the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, it issued a press release this week which congratulated the AP for getting the word skeptic out of the conversation, but which once again registered discomfort with the term doubter, which they said remains problematic and confusing. They're not satisfied.
Yeah, they're not satisfied. I don't think the AP's job is to satisfy the Center for Inquiry. They raised a legitimate question in the use of skeptics, and it's triggered this whole thing. And we went for the more precise language. Climate denial is the phrase invented by advocates and used by advocates. So are you, Bob, suggesting that we should adopt an advocacy role here?
I don't believe that just because a correct word is embraced by advocates makes the word any less correct. I'm not sure that the solution is to take from our quiver a very good arrow. If someone is merely a doubter in the continuum of thought on this subject, so be it. But if someone is an outright denier, call a thing by its name. James Inhofe, the chairman of the Senate Energy Committee, called global warming a hoax perpetrated by liberals. I mean, what do you do with people like that?
Doubt has more precision than denier because denier doesn't take in that whole spectrum. And even more precise than doubt is those who reject mainstream climate science. There's a perfect solution for Senator Inhofe, which is, as you just used right there, saying who calls global warming the greatest hoax. Why not let him use his words?
You do have a kind of fetching point that we only seem to have this discussion about the use of the word denier when it comes to climate. It doesn't find its way into stories about other contentious issues.
Yes. We don't talk about 9/11 deniers. We don't talk about moon landing deniers. What do we call the people who don't believe cigarette smoking causes cancer? We call them the tobacco industry. The trouble is there is no one perfect single word here. Denier is not perfect. And I'll tell you, doubter is not perfect. So we're dealing in imperfections here, and we're choosing the most precise of imperfections for the one word phrase. That's why the best phrase, granted, is a little longer, which is those who reject mainstream climate science.
Oh, yeah, that'll fit right snug in a headline. I just think that if you're going to choose between two words, I would choose the preciser and perfecter of the two.
And that's doubter.
I'm afraid I'm skeptical.
No, you're doubting.
Seth, many thanks.
Sure.
Seth Borenstein is a science writer for the Associated Press.
Coming up, abortion polls ask the wrong question.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Friday, House Speaker John Boehner announced he's quitting Congress at the end of October to protect the party from, quote, leadership turmoil. He said the move was long in the works, but news analysts suggest that the Pope's visit and the growing strength of the GOP's far-right flank may have spurred it. It's a flank that threatens to shut down the government next week if funding for Planned Parenthood isn't cut off for a year. Here's Tennessee Republican Phil Rowe at the end of last week.
I've seen the videos, and I can tell you that is not health care.
Rowe is talking about the now infamous Planned Parenthood sting videos released by an anti-abortion group called the Center for Medical Progress. In them, Planned Parenthood officials are seen discussing impassively, even callously, the cost of transferring fetal organs and tissues to researchers. Or as some newscasters on Fox have described them,
the undercover videos of Planned Parenthood officials talking cavalierly about crushing babies to preserve their organs for tissue procurement out there.
You're not going to believe what they caught this time. They're talking about full babies intact.
The release of the videos have added kindling to the long, blazing debate over abortion, one which the media and the polls paint as intractably black and white.
Coming up, abortion still divides these United States, and both sides are at war on the issue.
Americans have been divided over the issue of abortion since the Supreme Court decided Roe v. Wade almost 40 years ago.
Americans remain deeply divided on this issue. 49% believe abortion should be legal in most or all cases all of the time. 48% believe abortion should be illegal, with exceptions or banned outright. So that split couldn't be any closer.
But that split, says public opinions researcher Tressa Undum, doesn't tell the full story. In fact, she says the problem is that most polling on abortion is based on a question that is both outdated and profoundly misleading.
One group believes abortion should be legal in all cases or most cases. That's about half of the public. And then about half of the public, they report saying abortion should be illegal except in the cases of rape, incest, and mother's health, or it should never be legal. So that's how it's been measured over time for many, many years.
When you conducted your poll for Vox recently, you began with similar questions. Did you get similar results?
Yes, we did. We got 46% saying abortion should be legal in all or most cases, and 50% saying only legal in rape, abuse, and mother's health, or never legal.
But then you drill down on specifically the 34% of people who believe abortion should be legal only in rare circumstances, and you found a mess of contradictions. Let's start with their opinions on Roe v. Wade.
53% do not want to overturn Roe, which guarantees a woman's constitutional right to an abortion. I would not expect that. We also, you know, there's been a recent wave of hundreds of anti-abortion restrictions. So we gave them some information and said, do you think these restrictions are going in the right direction or wrong direction? 45% of this group who says legal only in rare cases say the restrictions are going in the wrong direction. When we ask, give us a word or two that describes how you feel about these restrictions, they say disturbed, they say horrified, offensive, ridiculous, sad, shameful, sucks.
Half of them used words like that, right? Others used words like needed, overdue, thrilled, encouraging.
Yes, exactly. But I would expect 90% of that group to say the restrictions are okay or I agree with them, and we just didn't find that.
You did something that I don't know that I've seen before, and that is you drilled down on what people thought of abortion in relation to their own personal lives.
Of that group who wants it in just rare cases, we asked, if a close friend or family member told you she decided to have an abortion, would you give her a lot of support, some support, a little, no support? 77% say they would give her support. 64% say they want it to be affordable. 59% say without added burdens. 58% would not want her to feel shame. Typical polling questions on abortion don't reflect how people experience this issue in real life. So we said, think about a woman who's decided to have an abortion. How would you want the experience to be for her? And then we said, non-judgmental, without pressure, supportive, without added burdens, affordable.
Wait a minute. You provided them with those potential options?
Yes. And we said, would you want it to be this way or not?
Aren't you stacking the deck there a little?
Well, here's the problem. We're trying to measure opinion on restrictions. There's been hundreds of restrictions passed in the past 5 years. The problem is people don't know anything about abortion. They don't know whether it's affordable. Is it safe? Is it accessible? You know, and some of these restrictions actually dictate that the doctor lie to women about the risks of abortion. When there's not a base of knowledge of what the environment is, it's hard to pull on those exact policies. So instead, we said, should it be informed by medically accurate information? Okay, that might seem biased, but in states around the country, doctors have to say abortion might cause breast cancer, and every doctor disagrees with that. So that's what we're trying to get at, measuring how they want the experience, which all these restrictions are about the experience, without people having to know what the status quo is. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes, actually it does. It still is problematic, you'd agree, right?
Yeah, that's why this issue is so hard. I've worked on the environment, I've worked on education, I've worked on all kinds of healthcare, I've worked on LGBT issues. This is the very hardest issue to get at really how people feel on abortion. And in my mind, it's nearly impossible to get through survey research. My best understanding of how people feel about this issue comes from qualitative research. Because people don't have any information. They don't know anything. It's kind of like Obamacare when we pull on that. The people who oppose it believe all of these things that aren't part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think opinion hasn't changed on the Affordable Care Act. Opinion hasn't changed on abortion in decades either. And I think part of the reason is there's a stigma about it. So we don't really talk about it. It comes up during election time. And people see it as a political issue. And every news article, it's a spokesperson from the pro-choice side, from the pro-life side, and then that's it. It's not a robust conversation. There's not a dialogue or learning about, okay, one in three women will have an abortion in her lifetime. People don't know that. They don't realize insurance doesn't cover it. They don't realize they might have to travel 100 miles. And people do have complex feelings. I mean, people do feel like you are ending a potential life. And they feel it's up to a woman to decide. This is a very gray issue, which is another reason why it's very hard to use survey research. And that standard measure that's been used, you know, it's archaic, frankly.
You mean the standard measure, do you think it should be illegal? Archaic because it's been legal for 42 years?
Yes, yes. In 40 years, are we going to ask, should the Affordable Care Act be repealed? I know we might think, yes, we probably will, but no, we won't. We might ask, do you support, you know, everybody having access to insurance or whatever? We might be debating that, but we're not going to be asking polling questions about should it be repealed, you know? We're not asking polling questions about the Civil Rights Act. Vox did a person on the street interview in a little video they put together. And this young guy, he says, I believe abortion is wrong.
I'm Christian, so I'm, what do you call it, pro-life. It's a life you're taking. Like, it's really considered murder because the baby has a fetal heartbeat. The baby's alive. So I think when the baby gets a heartbeat, that should be the cutoff point. That's just my stance. I'm not the kind of guy, like, I want everyone to follow my stance. All these laws that are, like, making it more difficult for women to get abortion, I think that's crazy.
And his exact opinion is why it's so hard to poll. I could hear that in a focus group and understand it. But in a poll, he would be labeled as Christian. He would be, it's illegal in all cases. He would be, it's murder at the heartbeat. But then he says, that's just what I believe. I don't need everybody else to believe what I believe. So this is hard.
Okay, one of the reasons we're talking about this now is because defunding Planned Parenthood is currently at the center of a fight that could potentially shut down the government. And there are the undercover videos of Planned Parenthood officials discussing fetal tissue. We heard it in the most recent debate. What do you think is the impact of all this kind of discussion now in the news on public opinion about abortion?
Zero. I think this is a non-moment. This is a non-issue. You know, I talk to voters all the time in focus groups. Last night I was in Cleveland. Planned Parenthood came up. People see it as a political issue that they're not sinking their teeth in. Yes, 20% of the public who says it needs to be illegal in all cases, they're vocal. This is very important to them. Among other people, it's just like another political attempt. So yes, this moment is going to pass. And guess what? It's not going to change. What would change opinion is if the debate around this, the dialogue about this was more about information, who has abortions, what are the laws around it, what do we want it to be like? But that I don't see at all.
Tressa, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Tressa Undum is a pollster at the public opinion research firm Perry Undum.
We know the internet has created countless ways to commune or commiserate with sympathetic souls. Illness is a particularly rich subject, with innumerable Facebook groups, blogs, and online communities designed to connect the afflicted and raise awareness worldwide. As one of our listeners, Nicole, told us earlier this year, such connections can be priceless.
I credit social media with leading me to the effective treatment for my cancer. I was diagnosed with stage 4 appendix cancer, which is a very rare cancer. You know, the prognosis is usually quite poor. But I was able to find a Facebook group, and talking to the patients on that group led me to a specialist in Baltimore.
But as with so much of the internet, there lurks a dark side. Online hoaxes, designed to generate cash donations or just the attention of strangers. Taryn Harper Wright devotes her free time to uncovering illness hoaxes. This began about 3 years ago while Taryn herself was bedridden after a hip injury with lots of free time to browse Facebook. One day, a post from Saskatchewan about the death of a woman named Dana Durr appeared in her newsfeed.
Dana Durr was a Canadian trauma surgeon and the mother of 11 children who was killed in a drunk driving accident on the night before Mother's Day.
Dana Durr was pregnant when this accident occurred, and she gave birth to a child right before she died in the very same hospital where she had saved lives daily for years. And if that weren't heart-wrenching enough,
the family also had a little guy who was, I think, 8 years old. He was just about to pretty much die from cancer when his mother actually was killed in the drunk driving accident. The father was a Canadian Mountie, and they had adopted a bunch of children. This came across my Facebook feed 3 years ago. The most tragic, awful story ever.
And you looked at this story and you said, oh my goodness, this is horrible. Wait, what? Your antenna went up.
It did. I did a Google News search right away just to see what these people looked like. Nothing popped up other than Facebook posts and blog posts that the family themselves had made. So that right away kind of tinged my radar, because mother dying on Mother's Day and delivering the baby as she was dying, that would have been something that somebody would have picked up on. Some of the pictures showed up in Google image search, and children who were supposedly the Durr children ended up being the children of a South African blogger.
So something was rotten in Saskatchewan. How long did it take you to figure out who was doing what and how?
It took a good 13 or 14 hours to get to who was behind the hoax. I kept updating my blog as the night went on, and I would get more and more emails from people who had interacted with the Durr family. Pretty soon I got a return address label from a woman in Ohio named Emily Durr. Turned out that she was the person that was behind the hoax.
What did she have to say to you?
At first, she said that her brother was a Canadian Mountie, that the story did really happen, that the reason that other people's children's pictures were involved was because he had a really top-secret government job and couldn't post pictures of his own family. We were, at that point, talking over email, and I said to her, you know, I don't believe any of this. Read the blog. We talked on the phone, and she basically confessed the whole thing.
You discovered how many fake Facebook profiles that she had to assemble to keep this Ponzi scheme of sympathy going?
She had 71 or 72 fake Facebook profiles. She also had sent out awareness bracelets, kind of like the yellow Live Strong bracelets that people wear, with Warrior Eli written on them to draw attention to her web pages and descriptions of the family's cancer battle.
Now, people who have seen the documentary called Catfish are probably familiar with this kind of pathology, someone perpetrating extraordinarily intricate frauds, not for any financial benefit, but, as you say, just to get attention. Did she seem especially needy to you when you spoke to her?
She had sort of a flat effect. I don't think she was going through a good time in her life. I don't think I'll ever really know her motivation, but I do think it was something that kind of snowballed out of control for her. She didn't really expect to pick up the following that she did. She didn't expect for people to kind of hang on every word that the family wrote on Facebook and on their blog. And honestly, when we talked on the phone,
she told me that she was actually glad that it was over with, that she had been kind of looking for a way out of it.
Now, Emily Durr was your first gotcha, but not your last and not even the most bizarre. Can you tell me about some of the other hoaxes you've uncovered?
We've had people who were faking cancer both online and in their real life, shaved their heads, told everyone around them that they had cancer. A lot of these people that make fake cancer battles online, they're exposed. They just kind of pack up shop and they move on to another blog or another support group or another Facebook group. It seems to be a real draw and a pull for them to do it again and again.
Now, there is actually a psychiatric condition that describes this very behavior long before the internet. It goes back to the middle part of the 19th century.
It's called Munchausen syndrome, and that's a condition in which somebody makes themselves physically sick for attention from doctors or from their loved ones. Munchausen by proxy is when somebody makes one of their loved ones sick, their children typically. And Munchausen by internet is when somebody goes online and poses as someone with an illness or someone who has a family member with an illness for attention and accolades from people who read their story.
So you go through many Facebook pages and other kinds of outreach. Are there any telltale signs for you that there is a hoax afoot?
Yeah. If you look at a page and it's just constant up and down drama, if they're not slipping into a coma one day, they're getting into a car accident the following day. There's always a baby that's in the neonatal intensive care unit. Just a ton of drama, like it's something that was on the WB or something. That to me would be a definite red flag.
Not only have you contacted these people and confronted them, you have since befriended a number of these people who were preying on the sympathies of outsiders. How did it happen that they became your friends?
I didn't expect it. I pretty much expected when I contacted them that they would be very angry with me. Along the lines of, you know, talking to them about what I had found out about them, I discovered that there were lots of things about them that I did like. I don't condone what they're doing, but at the same time, I can sort of understand why they're doing it. They're not in a good place. You know, they're not terrible people. They're not demons. I would never want to be judged by the worst thing that I did.
What's the worst thing that you've done?
I'm taking the fifth on that one.
I withdraw the question.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Is there anything that these people have in common?
We've had people that don't fit this mold, but typically it's a woman in their early 20s. To me, they sound like they're depressed. I almost feel sometimes like they're not comfortable with sort of sharing their own details, so they take on the persona of somebody that they admire.
Now, look, I don't want to sound like Oprah here, but as someone who had hitherto never really dug deep journalistically or otherwise into the secrets of the human heart, what have you learned from doing the blog WarriorElihoax.com?
That people's stories are deeper than you would give them credit for. That even somebody that, when I'm researching them, to me seems like the worst person on the planet, that when I talk to them and kind of get to know them, they are not somebody that is without good qualities. I've also learned that the internet is not the nicest place for people when something like this comes out, that people are pretty quick to form a virtual lynch mob. And that, to me, is sort of disturbing, too.
Taryn, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Taryn Harper Wright, former futures trader on the Chicago Board of Trade, runs the blog WarriorElihoax.com.
Coming up, how to hear what's going on in the heads of people who've never had a voice.
This is On the Media.
I got my potato
on Radiolab,
and I'm looking at it and I'm holding it.
We consider the mundane.
It's a handsome shape.
And stop to smell the potatoes.
I've been telling people about my potato. They're always surprised, and I say, you wouldn't understand.
Small potatoes on Radiolab.
It's my friend.
Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Amid the coverage of the refugee crisis in Europe, many reporters have sought to chronicle the individual stories of people en route. They're trying to convey both a particular set of circumstances and our common concerns, our shared priorities, family, shelter, food, dignity. Essentially, these reporters are striving to put directly before us the voices of people telling their own story, the voices we rarely hear. Enter Counter Narratives, a new collection of short fiction by writer and poet John Keane. In these luminous and layered tales, Keane conjures the voices of people at the margins of history and puts them at the center. History never happens in isolation, says Keane. Every story has a twin.
I was very interested in histories that are totally hidden, totally buried, totally obscured. Counter narratives are working against historical master narratives, and they play overtly with the writing of history.
Keane locates these twin stories in the tale of a slave who blithely disregards his constraints, in the spiritual and sexual union of two poets during the Harlem Renaissance, in the experiences that motivate an African dictator's nihilistic brutality. Keane is always challenging our assumptions. His characters are not acted upon or only acted upon. They are the actors. They choose to flee or fight or, even in one story, to very nearly fly.
So in Acrobatique, a real historical figure that we've really never, ever heard from, Miss Lala, the subject of Edgar Degas' famous painting, actually gets to describe her initial encounter with the person who memorialized her.
And we get to encounter her.
Exactly.
The painting is Degas' 1879 work titled Miss Lala at the Cirque Fernando. You've probably seen his rendering of a small, strong young woman suspended high in the atrium of the Parisian circus by a rope between her teeth. For 136 years, she's been frozen in that moment, silenced by the rope. But Keane puts us inside the head of Miss Lala, a.k.a. Anna Olga Albertina Brown, or in reference to her mixed race, Olga the Negress, the Venus of the tropics, the African princess.
Imagine this woman in the late 19th century who really was so extraordinary. She was such a superstar all over Europe. And she's captured in this iconic painting. And many people know of the painting, but almost no one asks the question, who was Miss Lala? The entire story is one continuous sentence. Here, Miss Lala is actually talking about letters that she writes back to her family.
Letters of a life so foreign, so exalted and dangerous for her and her performance partner, her family can't really respond.
And we prayed like Catholic girls to the saints that there would be no accident. There wasn't, though their letters in return never mention those bits, nor do they repeat a single word about all the other things. How I intend to spend every waking hour in the air, to soar with the brio of a sparhawk, and glide with a sparrow's ease, and float, as Kyra and I do, as the audience perches on the tips of their seats with the lightness of two creatures who have fully emerged from the chrysalis. How I want to suspend the entire city of Paris, or even France itself, from my lips. How I aim to exceed every limit placed on me, unless I place it there. Because that is what I think of when I think of freedom. That I have gathered around me people who understand how to translate fear into possibility. Who have no wings, but fly beyond the most fantastical vision of the clouds. Who face death daily back out into the waiting room. And I am one of them.
Probably Keane's most talked about story is Rivers, because we all have such a strong identification with its twin. It's the personal story of Jim Watson, the escaped slave from Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn.
reading this story as a young African-American junior high and then high school student was a somewhat traumatic experience. I loved the story, but I was also deeply disturbed by the story. And it was very difficult to come to terms with until I was much older, and then I was able to really appreciate what Mark Twain was doing. But I was always fascinated by Jim and Jim's life because he's so integral to Huck's experience, and yet we learn so little about him.
In Rivers, Jim, here called Jim Rivers, is interviewed by a journalist who wants his take on the events in Twain's novel. The story begins with Jim thinking what he doesn't want to talk to the reporter about, the two times he's seen Huck since the events of Twain's book. Once again, we are in the head of a character who we know, but never really knew.
Of course, the sort of natural inclination would be to focus on Huck and Tom Sawyer. And so I thought, how could I tell a story in which someone wants Jim to tell that story, but he tells another story, which would have been the story of my, I guess, great-great-grandparents or people like them living in places like Missouri, the Upper South. So all those things did kind of fit together.
Mm-hmm.
And then I bring Huck and Tom Sawyer back.
Jim encounters Huck and Tom long after the events on the river. As Jim considers what he isn't going to tell Tom and Huck, we're hearing what's going on in his head.
I think to conclude to the Sawyer boy and Huckleberry that I keep that certificate at all times and in all places against my chest in a leather pouch I bought for myself. And it reads James Alton Rivers, free person of color, a resident or citizen of the state of Illinois, at all times and all places, and entitled to be respected accordingly, in person and property, at all times and all places, signed with the seal of said court at Chicago on the 23rd of November in the year of our Lord 1852. And I have carried it all the way up to and through the time I returned to Missouri, settling here in St. Louis, since I was not ever going to set feet again in Hannibal if I could help it. And even when some of the Hannibal people, including the LaFleurs, have happened upon me down here, there's not a thing they could say or do because I had the states of Missouri, Illinois, and the federal government on my side. Though I've always made sure to have an escape route and a safe house on the other side of the river ready to flee to, given the trials the courts are putting Mr. Dredd and Mrs. Lizzie Scott through. Instead, I said, I was living in Chicago for a few years. Then I decided to come back home. I posted my bond to stay here, have been working steadily, and decided to settle down. Chicago, Sawyer said, looking at Huckleberry. Some go to Chicago and get ideas. The angles of that face, like broken porcelain, pulled apart and recombined until I almost didn't recognize him. Well, sounds to me like Jim is keeping himself out of trouble. And the worst thing for anybody these days is getting caught up in all that trouble. Getting involved with people like Lovejoy or Tory, or that new agitator writer, Mrs. Stowe, what likes to stir up a whole heap of trouble, too.
Keene's counter-narratives take many forms. Some are told through diaries or letters or spoken dialogues or internal monologues. One story unfolds as a 72-page footnote to a fictional encyclopedia. In the piece called Persons and Places, Keene presents two narrations side by side. On the left, the very young W.E.B. Du Bois, who would become a renowned intellectual and activist. And on the right, his Harvard instructor, George Santayana, the influential Spanish philosopher.
I was very interested in thinking about the relationship between these two very, very important figures. Du Bois was a student of Santayana. And in some of the biographies of Du Bois, and also in Du Bois's writing, he talks about studying with Santayana because it was a big deal, because Santayana was a major figure in American philosophy. In a really strange and enchanting memoir that Santayana wrote called Persons and Places, he talks about his time at Harvard and mentions many students, but strangely, he does not mention the student who, first of all, would have stood out just physically, but also who went on to become one of the major figures of his time. So I thought, what might that first encounter between these two people look like?
In this excerpt, Du Bois speaks first, then Santayana. Each describes passing the other on a chilly autumn afternoon in Harvard Square.
Why does he glower so? Is it fear? For certainly he has seen a Negro before. Or can it be an acknowledgement of how deeply we are linked? Or does he, like nearly all the rest of them, not really see me at all? Of course there will be scant possibility of a friendship, be he a Latin or the Statue of Liberty. For even Professor William James, in all his eccentric allegiance, admits, when we are at the same table, of all those unshakable walls that separate us. Still, I know that at some point soon, I shall have the opportunity to probe his mind, share my inquiries. He and I alone, in an upper room. And he will come to appreciate our common humanity.
This jeune philosophe, like the other Negro students, the handful of unassimilable Easterners, Chinese, Mexican boys, must by necessity subsist on an island even more remote than that on which I sojourned during my college days within this larger crimson archipelago. At one level, I imagine it would provide a place of refuge and some element of happiness for their small and scorned society. He observes me as if he has already examined the catalog of ideas and impressions which I shall tell him when we eventually speak, of the gulf between the true self and the world outside and how the mind, through its exercises, bridges it, of the importance of doubt in the philosophical method, of those fugitive joys and sincere ecstasies, that heaven that lies in the heart of the earth, of my own long and unfolding exile.
Keane wanted to have Du Bois and Santayana talking to each other,
but not exactly hearing each other. So the columns don't touch, and yet they're side by side, so there is this sense of connection and contiguity. These lives are unfolding in parallel. They are, like the columns, looking at each other, but they have not yet found the language to speak to each other.
I'm wondering how you view the role of fiction here. In counter-narratives, it seems to function as a kind of antidote to history, mm-hmm. a way to rebuke it or correct it through the poetic imagination.
Fiction, I believe, has tremendous empathic power. Some of the most recent studies in neuroaesthetics are showing this. In psychology and cognitive studies are showing us the power of fiction and narrative in general to shape our perceptions. Stories offer us a way to enter other bodies, other spaces, and help transform our own perspectives.
I know you wrote your own memoir of growing up in St. Louis. You have written the memoirs of people who never existed. It's almost as if the twin to their story in one sense is your own.
Exactly. In my first book, Annotations, which is a memoir, it's also a novel, it could be read as a long poem, it's sort of a hybrid of all these different genres. It was very much about my own experience, about the experiences of people my age, a little older, a little younger, growing up at a particular time, at a particular place, particularly Black, and in my case, queer, but many people have told me after reading it that it resonates for them, even though their personal experiences were very different. With this book, I wanted to step outside myself and to really think more broadly about the people who came before me, before us and to try to tell their stories. And so I saw that as a deeply ethical act, and I hope that I've done all of them justice.
John Keane's act is an elegant reminder of the countless hidden histories yet to be uncovered, as well as those we still choose to ignore. Maybe that's what the fiction and counter-narratives can encourage us to do, to seek out these kinds of stories, so they don't have to exist solely in our imagination.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Sam Dingman. We had more help from Alex Friedland, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week is Joe Plourd.
We had more help from Terrence McKnight. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
I hope you liked the show this week. I gotta tell you, we did. It's satisfying when we hit all the right notes. And it's really satisfying when you tell us we did, such as last week when Brooke asked you for your support and you came through big time. That was so great. Let's do that again, okay? Text OTM to 69866 to make a donation via your mobile device or visit onthemedia.org/support.